All it took for 100 people to die during a show by the hair metal band Great White was a sudden burst from four giant sparklers that ignited the acoustical foam lining the station nightclub. But who was at fault, and who would pay? This being Rhode Island, the two questions wouldn't necessarily have the same answer. In only 90 seconds, the fire killed 100 people and injured hundreds more. It would take nearly 20 years to find out why and who was really at fault. Best-selling author and three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist Scott James investigated all the central figures, including the band's manager and lead singer, the fire inspector, and the maker of the acoustical foam. The book is Trial by Fire, A Devastating Tragedy, 100 Lives Lost, and A 15-Year Search for Truth. It's a great pleasure to welcome Scott James to the roundtable this morning. Scott, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What got you on this beat initially?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Providence, and I've always thought that this was kind of the worst thing that ever happened to where I grew up. And so I live in California now, have lived here for more than 25 years, but I would come home, see my family and friends a few times every year. And over time, people would say to me, you know, that fire, it never really added up. We don't think we ever got the full story. There were never any trials, never a criminal trial, never a civil trial. So nothing was really laid out in court, all the evidence for people to consider. And they thought that there were unanswered questions. They also thought there had been a miscarriage of justice. So about 10 years ago, I just started asking some questions.
When you started to ask questions, what were you ultimately looking for? What were the questions, I mean, not all of them, but what were the basic questions that you were looking? Because there was so much left unanswered, right? I mean, that's the point.
Well, I mean, I thought one of the things that hit me very early in my process was learning that there had been three secret mock trials that were done with regard to this case. Now, I never went to an actual trial, but there were three mock trials done. So two were done by defense teams, and one was done by the state of Rhode Island. And I was tipped that in the mock trials, the state lost. In other words, the state couldn't get a conviction. And I thought, well, wait a minute. This is what the public has been led to believe is kind of an open and shut case against these people. So how is it, what was it that this impartial group of mock jurors heard that the public didn't hear, that when they heard it, they said, no, we're not convicting these people? So that was really interesting. And so eventually I find out exactly what the evidence was on the other side, different from what the state had presented. And then that is part of this book where I put that together.
One of the things that you point out is within hours, the governor of the state and the local police chief were calling for criminal charges. And this is as the investigation is just beginning. Really, there was little evidence at that point that had been gathered. There were victims that hadn't even been identified. So that started the finger pointing, which was really ineffective, wasn't it?
Well, it actually caused a domino effect. I mean, think of this. The police chief, while the scene is still active and no investigation, he has personally done zero investigation, told the Associated Press that the nightclub business owners, quote, most definitely would be indicted. So he pointed a finger of judgment in their direction before doing any investigation. I mean, at this point, they should be determining, was it an accident or was it a crime? So even before they knew anything, he was saying, oh, it's a crime, and these are the people who done it. So up until that point, and that was carried by the Associated Press, put up on Fox News and went all around the world. So up until that point, the nightclub business owners were cooperating with the investigation. They sat down for lengthy interviews with both the police and prosecutors. One of the co-owners was in Florida. He talked to the police over the phone. But after that statement became public and became known, needless to say, their attorney stepped in, and she was a former prosecutor from the attorney general's office. She stepped in and she said, you people cannot cooperate anymore. They've already decided you're guilty. They've already decided this is a crime and not an accident. So that really stopped a whole avenue for the investigation and for what the public would actually know about what happened, because those people never spoke again to the investigators. Because there was never a trial, they never actually said their side of the story. They never presented their evidence, counter evidence to the government's description of events. And in fact, they were very upset with media coverage, and they wouldn't talk to the news media until now. I mean, their first interviews about the fire, this is Michael Dedarian and Jeffrey Dedarian, nightclub business owners, were with me. And that's what we get in this book, among other things, is we hear their version of events, which is very different from what the government said.
I want to get to their version of events in just a second. For the few people who may be listening who do not know what we're talking about, February 20th, 2003, what happened basically? What happened at the nightclub?
So you had a band called Jack Russell's Great White, and they were famous for a song called Once Bitten, Twice Shy, which was back in the late 80s, early 90s. And during their heyday, they, you know, filled stadiums. They were a big deal. So now we get to 2003, their career has waned, and they go into this small roadside nightclub and put on their show. And as part of their show, they decide to light off fireworks. So kind of like reminiscent of their big stadium days. But they shoot off 15-foot gerbs in a club that has 12-foot ceilings. The place ignites in an inferno. Within 90 seconds, if you were still inside that club, you were probably dead. But the reason the club went up so fast was because on the inside walls of the club was this foam. It was foam that was meant to soundproof the club to appease neighbors who complained about the sounds leaking out of a rock and roll club. Now, the foam should have been sound foam, which is what is supposed to be flame retardant. You know, you work in radio, you work in studios. This is what you're surrounded by all right. the time is that kind of acoustic foam,
right.
which by law, if it's used inside around people, must be flame resistant. But the foam on the walls of the nightclub turned out to be packing foam, which is like solid. It's an accelerant. It's like solid gasoline. And in fact, on the walls of that club, they would find out later, was the equivalent of 13 gallons of gasoline. So when the spark hit that, it ignites instantly. And within seconds, parts of that club got to 1,400 degrees. People just never had a chance to get out alive. And there were other issues with people all ran towards one exit, which was kind of natural for people to do. You know, you go, your brain says you to get out, you go the way you came in. But there were three other exits that they could have gone out to and didn't for a variety of reasons. So it was just one mistake after another. The band claims that it had permission to light off fireworks, but that was not probably true. It turned out that lighting off fireworks in Rhode Island in that situation was illegal. They'd broken the law to do that. But also, people checked, New York Times checked within 24 hours. They'd gone around to the last half a dozen gigs that the band had played, and at every single club they talked to, the club owner said, you know what? They didn't have permission to light off fireworks here, and they did it here too. So there were a lot of things that were wrong simultaneously. People describe this as the perfect storm of fires because, frankly, if one thing had not gone wrong, everyone would have survived. I mean, the club didn't have sprinklers because state code didn't require them. So think about that. Sprinklers are a technology that dates back to the 1800s. But in Rhode Island, the club passed inspection as being perfectly safe, even though it didn't have these what we would consider kind of basic safety things. So the code failed, inspections failed. I mean, there were so many failures. And frankly, those are the ones that just start the book with regard to the fire. The failures would continue for years for these poor people who were the victims of this tragedy.
Scott James is our guest. The name of the book is Trial by Fire. One of the things that you talk about in the book, which is really surprising, is that the people that you talk to, really important people in the story, had never talked to anyone before. They had never talked to a journalist.
Right.
They had not given their side of the story. First of all, how does that happen, and how does that then assist you in putting the pieces together?
Well, what's really interesting about this is we know an awful lot about this fire because one of the weird twists of it was that inside the fire was a local TV news crew that happened to be there filming a story, ironically, about public venue safety. It was for one of these upcoming sweep series at Channel 12, one of the local stations. The reason they were at that station in particular was one of the co-owners was a guy named Jeffrey Dedarian, who was a local TV news reporter, in addition to being the co-owner of the nightclub. So here it is, a guy who is a journalist who has all of this is captured on tape, and it's his natural inclination as a journalist to want to tell his story. In fact, he would say to me years later, you know, he was the type of reporter who would, you know, was very aggressive, would chase the bad guys down the street outside the courthouse and ask them, you know, did you do it? Did you do it? And in his mind, the people who wouldn't talk were the people who had something to hide. So he wanted to tell his story. But see, after that remark where they were said, you know, the police chief basically pronounced guilt before investigation, what seems to be a kind of a classic rush to judgment scenario, they were pretty much silenced by their legal team. They did one press conference. It was 2 days after the fire, and it was a disaster because they gathered all the media. By that point, because this had been captured on video, it became a huge story, not just the death toll, which was enormous in the United States, but because of that videotape, the story went viral all over the world. The fire was literally captured on video from inside. Now, keep in mind that today, you know, everything is captured on video because we have our iPhones, but in 2003, the iPhone had not been invented yet. There were no smartphones, so footage like that was really rare. So this scrum of media appears from all over the world to cover this story, and the two nightclub owners decide to have a press conference. And they get into this ballroom, and they go to speak. And here's Jeffrey Dedarian, the TV news reporter who has done thousands of stories on live TV. He can talk up a storm, not a problem. He can't get a word out. He's so destroyed. He was inside that building when it caught fire. He saw people dying before his very eyes. He's completely traumatized. He tries to, like, begin to tell what they know, and he can barely speak. He just practically weeps for the entire statement that they made. Well, oddly enough, this did not go over well. Rather than seeing it, you know, having sympathy for the person that he too was traumatized by all of this, the story was kind of spun that he had, you know, these were crocodile tears, that he was acting, that he really didn't care about these people. It's just a really interesting way that the story was manipulated all the way around to kind of put the focus on them, these nightclub owners, to blame them for just basically everything, even though, as I told you, many, 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 many things went wrong in order to cause this tragedy. So immediately the focus went on to them. I studied the media coverage at the time. One of the local newspapers, the Providence Journal, did like 122 stories about the Dedarians after the fire. At the same time, the guy from the band who literally lit off the illegal explosives that started the whole thing, they did 18 stories on him. So they saw a bias. So they felt like they couldn't go to the media after all of that and share their story that way because they didn't get their day in court, but why not go to the press? And then 2 months after the fire, on the anniversary of the fire, the local newspaper, the Providence Journal, ran this story in their Sunday paper. It was one of these big six-column headline things where they described the nightclub owners as having a quote-unquote legacy of death. And the legacy of death story basically was that because they were of Armenian heritage, therefore their family came from a genocide. There's step number one in the argument that they have a legacy of death. Their mother died when they were small children. Well, there's step two, that they have a legacy of death. And then, of course, is the nightclub fire. And when they read that headline that day, April 20th, 2003, they vowed never to speak to a journalist again. And think about that. This is a guy who made his career in journalism, and he would never speak to another one. So when I came, you know, 10 years ago, snooping around and started to ask questions, I went to Jeffrey. I had worked with Jeffrey more than 25 years ago. He was an employee of mine as a reporter. And I thought, well, you know, I know him from then. Maybe he'll talk to me. And that's when I found out that they were so angry about the media coverage and how they had been thwarted in telling their story. It literally took me years to convince Jeffrey to speak. And then I had to convince his brother Michael to share his story. And then after that, other people came forward and started sharing their stories for the first time. And that's how the book came to be.
Real quick, who did not talk to you? You did not talk to Jack Russell, right? The lead singer.
Yeah, it was interesting. I talked to him a few times on the phone, little bits here and there. The interesting twist with Jack Russell is that he kept canceling our formal sit-down interviews to go through things. And then we had finally had another one set. We were ready to go. It was the very next day, and I was heading down to Los Angeles area to see him. And he called me up the night before, and he asked me for money. And I tried to explain to him, you know, it doesn't really work that way in journalism, in professional journalism, you don't pay people. And then he asked about, could we do a backdoor deal, which I assume means something like get some sort of cut of proceeds or something. And I told him, no, there would be none of that. And then when I told him he was not going to be able to make money off of this story, not through me at least, he canceled. And we never did that formal sent-out interview. But that doesn't mean he doesn't appear in the book, because right. Jack Russell talks. He does talk. And one of the things that happened recently, and it does go into the book, is in recent years he's been out bragging about how he had this criminal record that predates the fire. He was involved in an attempted murder of his drug dealer way back when, actually went to prison, spent time in prison. He was a young man, so he was released under California law, I think, when he was about 21, back into society. So there you go. Out of all the what-ifs of this tragedy, what if there had been sprinklers? What if that band never played there? Add another one, which is, what if the state of California put people in prison for more than 1 year for attempted murder? Then there would have been no Great White, and there would have been no Great White Fire, and none of these people would be dead.
And the other one that got away was the man that you mentioned a moment ago, who literally lit the fuse.
What's really interesting about Daniel Beakley is he has a very – he's been out of the spotlight since he served his time in prison. But we also hear from Dan Beakley for the first time in this book, because one of the things that was litigated over the years was to get released to the public the secret grand jury transcripts and other documents related to this case. So it's about tens of thousands of pages of transcripts and documents, and stuck behind another document labeled in some other way was this lengthy interview with Dan Beakley that goes on for dozens and dozens of pages by the prosecutors. This was done just shortly after the fire, and that had not really been explored or examined. So I've included that in here. So we hear him for the first time, what he has to say about things. What's interesting about that interview, it was one of these deals that was made with prosecutors, was basically sit down with us just after the fire, tell us everything you know, and we will not use it against you in a court of law as long as you don't lie to us. This probably would have been the same arrangement they would have given to the Dedarian brothers, the nightclub owners, except that, you know, somebody had already gone off in public saying that they were guilty. So the Dedarians are never going to take that deal. What's interesting about the Daniel Beakley interview is that he does lie to them in it, and that could have been used against him in court. But again, he also never had a trial. He did plead guilty. He took a plea bargain. And so he never had his day in court to explain everything. But he does in this book, because we have that document.
One of the big twists here in the book, and it's something that's just fascinating. It's tragic, but it's fascinating to read about, is the gulf really between the families of the victims and those who survived. That is a community you would think that would be united by this tragedy, and instead go after each other in really a horrible fashion.
You know, it was really the most surprising thing about working on this book. The way I structured this book is we follow a handful of people from before, during, after the fire, kind of the few to represent the many. But these are not random people. I pick people because they specifically are there when certain things happen. They're like in the room at pivotal parts of this story as it unfolds. And that was one of the things that just kind of blew my mind, was that the families of the victims who died hated the people who were the survivors, and actually would say just really blood-curdling things to them, to their face, like, you're alive because you stepped on my sister and left her for dead in that fire. Of course, there'd be absolutely no proof that anything like that happened at all. But it was fascinating that there was this wedge, and it really prevented them from coalescing as a community that could have advocated for themselves, that could have advocated for what they wanted from the prosecution or from the state. I mean, these people were neglected. They did not get the benefits that we think are there for people who are the victims of such a tragedy. They didn't get those things. In part, they were a fairly powerless group of people, mostly a working class, high school educated folks. So they didn't have necessarily the clout to deal with the system. And then add to that the fact that they're divided and they're fighting among each other instead of fighting against the system that really failed them and betrayed them. It is really one of the unexpected twists of the story. And I'm so glad you brought it up. Everyone who reads the book asks me about that because it seems just crazy.
Yeah.
But that is what happened. And I have to tell you, we're in 2020 and they still feel that way about each other. They still attack each other online. There are still trolls that will come after people who are survivors. I mean, really awful things that these people face after all they've been through. It's just crazy.
So ultimately, how do you think the history of this story will go down with what you have uncovered?
Well, what I hope is, and what I'm hearing, I mean, the book is just out, and so I'm just seeing initial reaction. What's very gratifying is when I see people writing online on reviews or whatever, that they had never heard of this, and they were shocked to hear that such a thing happened in the United States of America in kind of the modern age. So, yes, I'd like this to be remembered. I think there were lessons that should have been learned from this fire that weren't, but we can still learn them. We can still do things. I can tell you, deadly foam, like the type in the nightclub, is still being sold today. And it's still being sold today without warnings telling people that it's deadly foam. Now, we know that there are problems with buildings being inspected and fire codes. We know this because just in 2016, we had the Ghost Ship fire in Oakland where 36 right. people died. Different scenario, but really the same when we think about, well, why was that building such a death trap? And why wasn't it inspected? And why wasn't it people prevented from being hurt? So these tragedies are still happening. So our system, we didn't heed the lessons. And, it's not the first time. We've had many, many fail fires over the years where people say, they look at like the Coconut Grove fire of the 1940s, the Beverly Hills Supper Club 40 of the 1970s. And they're like, we're never going to let something like that happen again. But it does happen again. We have stubbornly had about 2,500 deaths per year in the United States from fires for the last like 30 years. We don't improve, even though medical breakthroughs are saving more people than ever, but the death rate stays constant. So we're not doing it. I want this to be a cautionary tale. I want people to remember this. And I hope the book brings it home in a way that allows people to really understand the issues here and how we really need our institutions that we think are going to be there to save us and protect us. We really need them to do it. And I'm not sure that that's really happening.
The new book by Scott James is Trial by Fire, A Devastating Tragedy, 100 Lives Lost in a 15-Year Search for the Truth. The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books. Scott, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Be well. Thanks so much. Again, the name of the book is Trial by Fire. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.